was described by one of my colleagues as saying that this was not the best possible deal, but it is the best deal possible.
The Alaska delegation weighs in on the debt deal. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, August 1st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, employees at the Bristol Bay Health Corporation struggle to accept more than a dozen layoffs.
I chose to come back and serve my people. This was not an arbitrary decision for me. This is my home.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
And by
AT&T, rethink possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
The U.S. House passed tonight a bill to raise the debt ceiling in exchange for spending cuts. The tally was 269 to 161. The Senate plans to vote tomorrow. Congress has pushed its votes to the brink. The Treasury Department set tomorrow as the day the nation risks defaulting on its debt. While some members of Congress proved hard for their leadership to convince to vote for the deal, Alaska's congressional delegation is solidly on board. APRN's Libby Casey reports.
Something is better than nothing, according to Congressman Don Young.
It's the best deal we can get. I am convinced of that.
Young says the plan to reduce deficits by more than $2 trillion over the next decade is probably the best that could be brokered. And he has praise for a man he sometimes clashes with, House Speaker John Boehner.
So I'm suggesting this is about as far as the Speaker could go. And I believe he's done a good job of negotiating with not many cards, because this is a hard group to negotiate. You have the Tea Party candidates, you have the conservatives, you have the moderates, and you have the liberals, even on our side. So it's sort of a split caucus.
And split House and Senate, one controlled by Republicans, the other by Democrats. Congressman Young says this deal heads off the danger of defaulting on the debt, and it gets the snowball of spending cuts rolling down the hill. Or, to mix metaphors, it takes a first bite from the fruit that is the national debt.
I'm one of these people that believe very strongly that if you swallow the apple, you'll choke to death. But if you nibble on the apple, you finally eat it. And this is the beginning. We've got the discussion about balancing the budget. That's in here.
The plan cuts spending more than it raises the debt ceiling. Initially, it cuts nearly $1 trillion over 10 years, but that's just part one. Part two is the creation of a bipartisan congressional group charged with coming up with ways to save $1.5 trillion more, be it through cuts or reforms to taxes or entitlement programs. Now, Young says he doesn't see the point of another commission.
I'm not happy with that. I've told the leadership, but why should we set up another committee? Because then why should we have the budget committee? Why should we have the authorization committee? Why should you have appropriation committee? Why don't you just have this little czar group? But they think this will solve the problem. You know, it's like a BRAC commission.
The debt committee would have until Thanksgiving to propose solutions, and Congress would have 1 month to act. If it does not, deep cuts would be triggered. And they include two things Senator Lisa Murkowski doesn't like: cuts to defense spending and a hit to providers of Medicare patients. But she says that can be avoided.
Remember that that is the fallback position. This is the enforcement mechanism that pushes all of us, all members of the House, all members of the Senate, to make sure that this select committee does the work that we've requested it to do.
Murkowski says the committee will have a real incentive to come up with solutions. Her general take on the deal is that it's fair, even though it's not, in her opinion, ideal.
Those of us that are looking at the contours of this deal believe that this is a step in the right direction. As we work to aggressively reduce our spending. Nobody that I have talked to believes that this is a perfect deal. It was described by one of my colleagues as saying that this was not the best possible deal, but it is the best deal possible.
Senator Mark Begich had some specific changes he wanted in the proposal, like boosting taxes on millionaires. That's a deal breaker for some Democrats who won't vote for it. But Begich is on board.
It has meaningful reductions, but they're split between the Pentagon and discretionary, which I think was important. The other it does is protect, in this first phase, clearly it protects Medicare and Social Security benefits.
And Begich says it gets the Congress and the U.S. out of what he calls a hyperventilated legislative process.
The most important thing we can do right now is get us focused on the economy and create some certainty. And I think this does create some certainty, because now we have several months ahead of us. That we can focus on jobs rather than another 3 months from now, the debt crisis, another 3 months, the debt crisis. So I think that's a good sign.
But focusing on other issues can only happen once the deal is passed out of both bodies of Congress. And until then, the clock is still ticking on the threat of default. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
This spring, the Bristol Bay Area Health Corporation cut 19 employees in two rounds of layoffs. They were the first Indian Health Service-funded health care provider in Alaska to blame the budget woes in Washington, D.C. for layoffs. KDLG's Daisha Eaton has been following the issue and has part one of a two-part story from Dillingham.
Debbie Coolidge lives in the village of Aleknagik, where her Yupik ancestors are from, in a simple one-story house with her family.
This is Lena and Freddie, my twins.
My name's Lena, I'm 14, and I'm going to be in ninth grade.
My name's Freddie, I'm 14, and I'm going to be in ninth grade.
We're going to move to Sitka. It should be an adventure.
Coolidge has brown skin, light eyes, and a hearty laugh. After working as a health aide for the Bristol Bay Area Health Corporation for 10 years, Coolidge decided she wanted to serve her community in a bigger way. So she uprooted herself, along with her adopted niece and nephew, to Anchorage, then to Seattle, winning an Indian Health Scholarship and earning a Bachelor of Clinical Health Sciences and a Physician's Assistant Certificate from the University of Washington. She returned to work at the Bristol Bay Area Health Corporation in Dillingham, fulfilling her dream of caring for her people.
You know, the beauty of what I do is I can go anywhere and find a job, but I chose to come back here. I chose to come back and serve my people. This was not an arbitrary decision for me. This is my home. These are my people. These are the people that I care about.
But that dream was cut short in March.
You know, everything was going well. You know, I know we had a couple of physician positions open, so I thought, you know, we had been budgeted out for a couple of extra provider positions anyway. I thought my position was secure. I only worked there from June of 2009 to when I got laid off in March.
Coolidge's position was one of 19 that were cut in two rounds of layoffs this spring. The BBAHC employs over 360 people and manages a budget of roughly $50 million. Robert Clark, president and CEO of the BBAHC, blames the federal government for the layoffs.
The short of it is, we have not received our promised budget, and we were only getting a small amount. Our plan for 11 was too big, because it was based on money that never came. Congress went through 8 continuing resolutions. Then they gave us the balance of our budget, a little over $30 million. So it's close to a couple million less than we had originally anticipated.
Those continuing resolutions, Clark says, eventually trickled down to the local level, freezing funding at 2010 levels and slowing distribution of federal dollars via the Indian Health Service. Clark says the BBAHC expected to receive $31.9 million, but in the end, they received $30.2 million, a 2% across-the-board cut. The BBAHC isn't alone. Just a couple of weeks ago, the Kotzebue-based Manilik Association laid off 40 employees, also blaming continuing resolutions in Washington and cuts in IHS funding. The BBAHC receives more than half of its budget from federal dollars. There are 25 Native health organizations funded with the federal dollars via the Indian Health Service in Alaska. So far, Manilik and Bristol Bay are the only two laying off workers. The Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation in Bethel is one of the other 23 organizations that's been unfazed by the budget delays in Washington. According to President Gene Peltola, he says that's because they planned ahead.
prolonged and continuing resolutions up until recently have had no effect on the Yukon Kuskokwim Health Corporation's operations.
You haven't had to lay anyone off?
We haven't had to lay anybody off this year because of the appropriation process.
I called all the other Native health organizations in the state of Alaska, and none of them indicated that they had to cut workers, although many did not return repeated phone calls. The BBAHC runs Kanakanak Hospital, the only hospital for both Native and non-Native citizens in the Bristol Bay region, as well as 29 village clinics staffed by approximately 75 health aides. In part two, we'll take a look at what the layoffs mean for the city of Dillingham and whether they're an indicator of what's to come in other parts of the state. In Dillingham, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, recovering a bomber that crashed 60 years ago north of Talkeetna.
Everybody had tears in their eyes when they brought the tail in because it's been
set. Oh my God, my camera was shaking.
Yeah.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The future of how Alaskans will produce the energy we need for our homes and businesses is uncertain. The Renewable Energy Alaska Project is committed to developing Alaska's vast renewable energy resources to create a clean, local, and sustainable energy supply. Learn more at realaska.org. This message sponsored by REAP, committed to creating a sustainable economic future for Alaska.
The fatal mid-air collision over the weekend near Trapper Creek is the second in Alaska in less than a month. A family of four died when their single-engine Cessna 180 float plane crashed Saturday after hitting another float plane. The pilot of the other plane was able to make an emergency landing. In mid-July, two small planes collided over Lake Clark Pass. No one was injured in that crash. A federal accident investigator says both collisions involve planes that were difficult to spot amid mountainous backgrounds. Now the FAA is planning to hold safety meetings with pilots on ways to see other aircraft and to be seen. Drew Haig is a pilot in Talkeetna who owns Above Alaska Aviation Flight School. He agrees it can be difficult to spot aircraft and says flying in Alaska is different than the lower 48 because there isn't as much radar coverage.
Up here in Alaska, our radar coverage is very limited, so we don't have that luxury or that added service. So it's pretty much see and avoid in most places in Alaska, which means you look out the front of your window and you try to find other airplanes, and when you see them, you avoid hitting them.
How fast are these planes, these smaller planes, normally traveling?
Anywhere from 85 miles an hour to 160 miles an hour.
So when they do see each other, there's not much time to react?
It all depends. I mean, if you've got another aircraft that's flying across your field of vision, you're going to be able to see them easier than if they were on a convergent path with you. So the see and avoid procedures are to look outside the aircraft when we have time, when we're not managing the aircraft systems. And to do that, we take 10-degree increments of the sky and spend about a second or two in each 10-degree increment scanning up and down so that we can pick out any objects that might be moving out there. And then we move to the next 10-degree increment. Now, unfortunately, we have to also manage the aircraft, so as we're scanning, we stop in the middle of our scan after a few seconds of scanning and go back to our instruments and controls, make sure the aircraft is where we want it, and then we go back to our scan. So we ultimately want to scan our visual horizon for other traffic using that procedure.
I would imagine that, or does it get easier over time? It sounds as if it's difficult in some settings to see other aircraft that may be too close. Does it get easier over time to spot other planes?
Your mind will get accustomed to scanning rather than having to make a voluntary effort to scan, and you get used to how you scan. After you pick out several aircraft, you realize, you know, your mind adjusts to the proper way.
And is there any risk associated with that after you've done it for a long time?
Well, I would say if there's a risk involved, it's probably complacency. If we get used to not running into other airplanes, we tend to think that it might not happen to us, so we end up t- talking with our passengers or getting distracted from our scans. So I think complacency would be a potential risk, and it's just important to keep your eyes out there and make a conscious effort to do that.
Well, based on what you've just discussed about the potential difficulty in seeing planes in certain settings and the amount of air traffic that we have in Alaska, are you surprised that there aren't more mid-air collisions?
Not necessarily. I think overall pilots use the scan procedures and the see and avoid process, and a lot of collisions are avoided because of spotting those aircraft and avoiding them. And it's, you know, it's a very large state. There's a lot of open air out there, so the odds are pretty slim of being in the same spot as another airplane at the same time.
Drew Haig owns Above Alaska Aviation Flight School in Talkeetna. The bodies of two plane crash victims on Juneau's Douglas Island have finally been recovered. Weather cleared enough Friday evening for a helicopter to reach the site of the wrecked fuselage, which still held the bodies of Charles Luck and Liping Tang Luck. Their Cessna 182 had crashed 6 days before on Mount Ben Stewart near the Eagle Crest ski area. A Temsco helicopter with state troopers on board tried several times last week to access the steep site, but the cloud ceiling was always too low. Parts from the single-engine plane are scattered over a wide area on the mountain. Now that the bodies have been retrieved, a National Transportation Safety Board crew will attempt to recover all the parts of the plane so it can be reconstructed for the investigation into the cause of the crash. Charles Luck was a physician's assistant at the Hoonah Health Clinic. He and his wife were flying from Hoonah to Juneau early on the morning of July 24th when the plane crashed. In September 1951, a B-17 bomber crashed north of Talkeetna along the Chulitna River. Bush pilot Chuck Hudson is credited with saving the lives of those on board. The wreckage of that plane is being airlifted out of the wilderness to Talkeetna and will be readied for transport to Ohio to the Champaign Aviation Museum. The working pieces of the Talkeetna wreckage will be used in a restoration project that will result in a flyable B-17. For member station KTNA, Sue Dio has the story.
The Talkeetna Airport has become a hub of the recovery of a B-17 bomber crash that occurred along the Chulitna River in 1951. 60 years ago, this September, a crew took off from Elmendorf Air Force Base to fly a B-17 to Fairbanks.
Over Talkeetna, they experienced some engine problems that led to a fire, which later led to the engine falling off after it caught fire. And they had some control problems, altitude problems, only one engine running. So they ended up landing it in the trees up here about 9 miles north.
Paul Good is a retired Air Force officer and a volunteer on the B-17 restoration project at the Champaign Aviation Museum in Urbana, Ohio. And people should not confuse this B-17 bomber crash with the infamous story of a C-47 crash in 1954 on Kasugi Ridge. Pioneer Bush pilot Cliff Hudson was involved with both.
And they were on the ground. Somebody heard the crash, and Cliff Hudson went up, and he discovered it. And then he called up flight service here, and they got helicopters in the air and effected a rescue.
A team of almost 20 people from Ohio have assembled in Talkeetna. This week and next, parts of the plane are being rescued and transported back to Talkeetna for a long, arduous journey to Ohio.
Light loads. We're trying to make them heavy enough.
Yeah.
A team stayed at the crash site on the Chulitna working on sling loads Thursday afternoon, while the other part of the team worked at the Talkeetna Airport to move pieces of the plane as they landed. In between sling loads of plane parts, Good gives a short history of the project.
The project started back in 2005 when a gentleman called Jerry Schiffer, who was the owner of a plastics company back there that made plastic containers for the food industry. Jerry was very aviation-oriented, and he sought and found a B-17 project. Jerry himself was a very well-qualified pilot. Unfortunately, the day before this was delivered, our project, Dave was killed in an aircraft accident.
The Schiffer family is paying for the entire project. As parts were dropped off, Good wandered around checking out the loads.
Yeah, I'll tell you a story about that. The reason we're all grinning, because that's $30 a minute. This is called part of the cheek turn, the turret, cheek gun turret up front. We couldn't get any, and it was going to cost us $80,000 to make a die to stamp that out.
Good's wife, Dottie, is right alongside Paul, reprimanding those that get too close or those that need to wear gloves. She's just excited as her husband.
Everybody had tears in their eyes when they brought the tail in because it's been
set. Oh, my God, my camera was shaking.
Yeah. Because it has been a long, hard year. Someone's asked me, said, won't you be glad when Paul gets through with this mission and maybe he can spend some more time with you? And I said, oh, no, I've enjoyed it too.
The project may take 10 more years to complete. Some of the parts will be disassembled into smaller pieces to fit into a shipping container, which will be hauled to Anchorage in order to be barged to Seattle. From there, it goes by train to Ohio. At some point, the parts will become part of Champagne Lady, a working, flyable part of history. In Talkeetna, I'm Sue Dio.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com.
The scientist who first reported seeing dead polar bears in the waters of the Arctic Ocean says he has still not been told why he's under investigation. Federal officials issued a brief statement Friday responding to news media accounts about polar bear researcher Chuck Monette being placed on administrative leave. Coming from the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, Regulation and Enforcement's Deputy Chief of Staff, Melissa Schwartz in Washington, the statement denies that Monette's 2006 scientific paper that revealed the polar bear deaths, which were likely due to vanishing sea ice, has anything to do with the Inspector General's investigation that prompted the agency to pull Monette off duty earlier this month and put him on leave 2 weeks ago. Jeff Rook of the organization Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility says the statement makes the situation even more mysterious. Peer has filed a complaint on Monette's behalf and alleges that Monette and a co-researcher have been harassed within the agency since before its name was changed from the Minerals Management Service, specifically ever since the paper was published in 2006. Schwartz says she won't speak further about the investigation. Her boss, Bomer head Michael Bromwich, is already on record saying his personnel in Alaska should not talk to the news media. For years, scientists and fishermen alike have wondered why the stellar sea lion stock in the Western Aleutians continues to shrink. A new report from the states of Alaska and Washington doesn't definitively answer that question, but it does criticize the federal government's approach to reviving that population through the closure of commercial fisheries. KUCB's Alexandra Gutierrez has more.
Last week, a scientific panel put together by the states of Alaska and Washington quietly released a draft report on the management of stellar sea lions, an issue that's been at the center of controversy in the Aleutian region for years. The document is a critique of the National Marine Fisheries Service 2010 biological opinion on the endangered western stock, who have continued to see their population shrink and their birth rates decline. The biop determined that commercial fishing was likely creating competition for food, and it led to the closures of the Aka mackerel and Pacific cod fisheries in the Western Aleutians. It also resulted in an outcry from the fishing industry and litigation from the state of Alaska and others. According to the draft report, those closures might not have been warranted. The four-person panel writes that they were not convinced by NIMS' rationale for closing the fishing grounds and that they did not believe that NIMS gave enough weight to the theory that the population decline could be connected to killer whale predation or that it might be the result of the sea lions eating the equivalent of marine mammal junk food.
As a review panel, we had significant issues with some of the scientific conclusions of the biop.
That's Gunnar Knapp, a University of Alaska economist with expertise in fisheries management and a member of the panel. He says that NIMS also used a looser definition of the word likely than most scientists would. He adds that they should be using the word likely to mean probable, as in, it's probable that you can buy eggs at the grocery store. Instead, he says that NIMS has been using it to mean not impossible, as in, it's not impossible that you might see a movie star at the grocery store.
It suggested that the sort of standard for likely that they were using was something less than the weight of scientific evidence, and they were using phrases such as, well, this may be happening, or we can't rule out the possibility that, and so on.
Doug DeMaster is the director of NIMS Alaska Fisheries Science Center, and he says NIMS welcomes independent reviews of their biological opinion. But he says he has some concerns as to how independent this review is, given that it was organized by states with clear interests in keeping fisheries open and that some of the panels are affiliated with these states.
My sense is that the selection process for the panel members wouldn't meet the NOAA standards for an independent peer review. And so we'll probably say something about that. Two of the four panel members, for example, that will work for the states of Alaska and Washington. One of the other panel members has a contract with the industry that has a vested interest, and the fourth panel member has a contract with the state of Alaska.
Knapp says that he disagrees with that sentiment and that the states were removed from their review process.
The state of Alaska and the state of Washington made it clear that they were asking for an independent opinion, and they didn't get involved in any way, and you know, they had no part whatsoever in our discussions.
In the meantime, NIMS continues its stellar sea lion research to get a better picture of what's happening to that stock.
We're planning on putting satellite tags on adult females this fall, late summer, early fall. So we'll get a much better sense from animals in the Western Aleutian area in terms of, are they feeding inside or outside a critical habitat, and how hard are they working when they're foraging.
The panel will be taking public comment on the report in Anchorage on August 22nd. In Unalaska, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Daisha Eaton in Dillingham, Rosemary Alexander in Juneau, Sudio in Talkeetna, and Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Kristen Spack, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by North Rim Bank, taking your business to the next level. With help from North Rim Bank, spot the turns and opportunities that lie ahead for Alaska. More at northrim.com. Member FDIC. A PFD reminder, check the status of your 2011 PFD application with My PFD Info online at pfd.alaska.gov. You can view or change your voluntary deductions until Wednesday, August 31st. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska. Quitting tobacco is the best thing you can do for your health. Join a free program that will help you create an easy-to-follow plan to quit. It will show you how to get ready, take action, and then live the rest of your life as a non-smoker. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line provides 8 weeks of patches, gum, or lozenges, and quit coaches that are trained to address Alaskans, including expectant mothers. There's more information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line. It's free, it's confidential, and it works.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.